Hello, and welcome to Spy Hard's podcast, where your hosts go deep undercover into the world of spy movies to decipher which films make the knock list. But remember, this information is strictly for your ears only. I'm Agent Scott.
And I'm Cam the Provocateur, and Scott, my leg is bad tonight.
Along with everything else.
The leg caught up. This is an announcement. I'm on a gurney right now.
Just in plaster cast, just basically being held together.
That's right, that's right.
Which is how my body feels these days too, to be fair.
Nurse Helen, help!
Kiss me while I'm sleeping.
I love you!
It's called Nightingale Syndrome, and you should probably see someone about it, Sonny Jim. But before we get to all that spy jinx, Cam, we need to induct our latest Spy Hard diehard.
And that's right. If you want to become a Spy Hard's diehard, leave a 5-star review for us on Apple Podcasts, and then tell the world what you enjoy about Spy Hard's, and then we read it on the air and give you your top secret code name.
Someone asked us recently, why do we do it on Apple Podcasts when I listen on Spotify or I listen on Google Podcasts? It's because Apple Podcasts is the only place you can actually leave a written review, and we love reading your little letters to us.
Yeah, well, exactly. So I think this makes a lot of sense, and who knows, maybe at some point we'll be able to expand, but in the meantime, Apple Podcasts is where it's at.
Okay, so I'm going to address an old review from a while back, and then talk about a 5-star one. So I'm gonna shout out to the only 1-star review we ever had in our life. Would you like to hear it, Gam?
Okay, please.
Okay. I think we might prove his point. 1-star from C. Crandall. Too much talking about everything but the film.
Okay. Sure.
Well, right now we're proving him right. Maybe we did earn that 1-star. We're sorry, C. Crandall or Crandall.
I don't know what to say to that. What's his nickname?
That's best left for off the mic.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough.
But on the flip side of that, a lovely 5-star review here.
Actually, I have the nickname. The nickname, what was the name of that reviewer?
C. Crandall.
Okay, your nickname is Bennett's Secretary. Run wild with that one.
XXXXXXXX.
Bennett's Secretary.
None of these jokes are landing to anyone because most people haven't seen this film. So this is beautiful. We'll keep it up. That's true Spy Hard's fashion. But here is the 5-star review from Nerdrovert. 00 awesome. If you love Bond, Bourne, and everything in between, this is the Spy Podcast for you.
Well, thank you very much, Nerdrovert. And your nickname will be Valdar, which that's a good one, right? V-A-L-D-A-R, Valdar.
Agent Valdar, or would you just go by Valdar?
Whatever he prefers.
Sure. Well, there you go. Nerdrovert, you now officially are Valdar. Please change all your social media handles to @Valdar, and make sure you change your images to Boris Karloff.
That's right, that's right. And you have to also add a scar from now on, maybe like a prosthetic scar on your face at all times.
Or really go method, if you'd like. That's really down to you, though.
And also speak in 3 accents as well.
Yeah, but unconvincingly.
Okay, that's fair.
Well, there you go. That was our latest Spy Hard Die Hard inductee. Thank you to Nerdrovert, a.k.a. Valdar. If you want to get on this list, make sure you leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. But Cam, let's get to the review. All right, folks, it's time to talk about this week's film. Cam, I'm firing a shot across your bow. What are we talking about?
We are talking about 1939's British intelligence, which is also often considered 1940s British intelligence. This movie was released in Australia at the tail end of 1939, but the rest of the world didn't see it until 1940.
So, as always, the land down under is leading the charge.
Exactly, yes. It's kind of one of those, like, little things we've had a few times where, like, the movie was released. I think there was one we did on the show that was released in Canada on, like, Christmas Day, and the rest of the world all saw it in January. So it's considered, like, a, you know, a release from the Canadian release date. But it gets very screwy, especially when you're trying to do box office stuff, and you're like, well, what year am I looking at here?
And also, I believe this has a name change at some point in its history, too.
Yeah, it was called Secret Enemy when it was released in Australia, and that was the shooting title. But it was called British Intelligence everywhere else in 1940.
Okay. Well, if you've never seen Enemy Agent before, slash British Intelligence, slash
Secret Enemy.
It's also called Enemy Agent on IMDb if you look at it right now.
Oh, is it? Okay. Well, fair enough.
Yeah. Three titles, folks. A lot to keep track of. Apparently, Cam can't keep track of it, and he is our master of the records.
Hmm. True. Yes. British Intelligence, though, it's not one where it's like juggled around a lot of different titles the way that some are. There are movies we have tackled that literally have two titles and, you know, artwork that's North American that is different. We've had a few of those on the show. This one, it's just a couple territories the title was different, but British Intelligence is pretty far and wide the title.
And something I sorely lack.
You beat me to that joke.
I wanted to get there first because I knew you were going to use it.
I was like, for Scott, that's an oxymoron.
You're a moron. Okay, well, if you haven't heard of British Intelligence, it's a Spy Hard special, as we like to say. It's a film you've probably never heard of, and most of you haven't seen. Luckily, it is available on YouTube, folks. I'll jump in early and let you know. You can watch it, and it's only an hour long.
Yeah, it's on YouTube easily. I watched it on Tubi, actually. It was streaming on there. And the print that they had on Tubi was actually really good. It was not like when we did I Was a Spy relatively recently, where the audio was a little muddy. British Intelligence looked and sounded great.
The YouTube version has like built-in subtitles, like baked in. You can't get rid of them. And they're really goofy.
Okay. Well, if you're in Canada, Tubi is where it's at. I don't know if that applies also to the US and the UK and elsewhere, but Canadians, we're laughing. We are loving our Tubi experience with British Intelligence.
You've got so much intelligence over there. Canadian intelligence.
We do, eh?
Eh? Well, here is your synopsis. British Intelligence. Although the home of Cabinet Minister Arthur Bennett is a hotbed of spies, moles, and double agents. No one knows the true identity of notorious German spy master Strindler.
Yeah, yeah.
We're not done yet.
Oh, there's a more?
There's not a more, but there's a second paragraph.
Oh, interesting, okay.
Yeah, I don't know if it adds anything though, but we'll find out. During World War I, pretty German master spy. I mean, someone's really leaning into the pretty part there. They've added that one. That's a little bit of editorialization there. Helen von Lauber is sent undercover to London to live with a family of high-placed British officials, where she is to rendezvous with the butler Valdar, also a spy, and help him transmit secret war plans back to Germany.
Yeah, this is a movie that's very plot-focused. Very plot focused, and that is a pretty good summation of the plot. It's funny because like it's actually a pretty convoluted movie. It reminded me a lot of Spy Ship at times, where I was like, smoke was coming off my pen as I was taking notes, trying to keep track of what was going on scene to scene. This one's not quite in the extreme of Spy Ship, but it's edging up to it.
I was halfway down my page of notes about 20 minutes in.
yeah, same.
I had to slow down. I was like, I've only got an A5 here, folks. I can't fill that one in. This is a Spy Hard special, so there's no point belaboring it and asking if we have a background with this, because I don't think either of us have a background with this film.
I have a rich backstory with British Intelligence. I mean, it really started probably around when I was 6 years old, and I saw it in theaters.
Right.
It was a trying time, and it brought us the morale to move forward. And it's a movie that I've continued on with for decades to come. Every actual year on my birthday.
Right.
British Intelligence, right at 6 a.m. Perfect time.
You stick on that Betamax and give it a watch.
That's right. That's right. No, I had never heard of this or seen it before.
No. There's someone listening who has actually like seen this film before without like watching it ahead of time.
Oh, I don't think it's as obscure as some of the other ones. Because of the fact it has Boris Karloff, I think there's a certain segment of film lovers that would watch it. It's probably included in some like DVD 20 packs along the road or something like that. You know, like the Karloff collection or something like that. World War II films. I suspect this one isn't as obscure as like I Was a Spy or Spy Ship.
There's some interesting images on the IMDb page for this. Some very weirdly put together bits of artwork, but two of them are there's a DVD pack of An Evening with Vincent Price and Friends that features this film.
Okay, sure.
Also on that box set, I don't know if you've seen any of these films, but I'll read them out to you, Cam. You've got The Last Man on Earth.
Seen it. Very good.
House on Haunted Hill.
Very good.
The Bat.
That one's okay.
The Magic Sword.
Have not seen that one or heard of it.
And British Intelligence. And there's also a Boris Karloff double pack with British Intelligence with a really badly photoshopped image and Sabaka.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen that one. I will say, going back to Last Man on Earth, that was actually the first film adaptation of I Am Legend. And really worth checking out. It's like 75 minutes, but really well done.
Okay. That's an interesting one. And that one's presented in widescreen.
That one actually holds up pretty well. I have a copy of it here. And that and House on Haunted Hill are the two gems that you named there.
Okay, fair enough. But it actually did come with some sort of DVD multi-packs.
Okay, yeah, it just seems like the kind of movie, it's the case with so many of these B-movies. They fall into somewhat public domain and they wind up on a billion different DVD sets that are super cheap and sell you like 50 crime movies for $8, that kind of thing.
So are we going to be releasing our own at some point?
Well, one would hope. That would be actually pretty great. The Spy Hards collection, which has nothing but like forgotten movies like Spy Ship and Sleeping Car to Trieste and whatever else.
House on 92nd Street.
Yeah, exactly.
To be fair, like, I mean, if they're in the public domain, are we able to just do that? If you get a copy of it, you just make a DVD?
We'd have to figure out which ones are public domain and which ones are movies that the studio doesn't care about at all.
Right.
You know, so you'd want the public domain ones. I believe, I may be wrong, but I think British Intelligence actually is public domain now.
Okay, fair enough. I wish the public domain had more British Intelligence. But thank you, everyone. I'll be here all week. But Cam, let's figure out, how did the Brits get so intelligent?
Okay, well, this was based on a 1918 Broadway play called Two Faces East, by Chicago-born writer Anthony Paul Kelly. Anthony Paul Kelly actually had a very short life. He died of suicide at the age of about 35. But he was reasonably prolific in a short period of time. He started writing in the movies in his teens in 1914 and wrote a lot of shorts and had a lot of scenario credits. So he wouldn't be necessarily writing dialogue, but he would come up with scenarios for movies and get credit there. That's kind of one of those early credits that's a little bit akin to like the story credit, but also a little different.
Mm-hmm.
WGA back in the day, folks. And his probably biggest credit early on was the 1920 D.W. Griffith film, Way Down East, with Lillian Gish. And D.W. Griffith was one of the big silent filmmakers, made Birth of a Nation, a very troubling film. And then he also made like Intolerance, which is very good. He also did, the writer Anthony Paul Kelly also wrote a 1923 silent spy film called Silent Command that I've added to our list to cover at some point in the future.
Ooh.
Hopefully we can track it down. But
you'll never hear it coming.
But that play, Two Faces East, was adapted into three film projects. So in 1926, they made a silent version of the story, and they called it Three Faces East. So they added an extra face in there. I'm not sure if the play is a little more simple. I'm not really sure. I'd have to like go back to the original source material of that play, and I don't know if there's like a, you know, like if it's written down anywhere. Like if I could buy a copy or get a copy online, maybe I could. But I'd be curious to know what the change is. But yeah, the 1926 one was a silent film, and then in 1930 they did a studio version with sound, so it would have been one of the earlier talkies and was much more of like a lavish production. And then lastly was this movie, British Intelligence, in 1939. So that's after Anthony Paul Kelly has passed away. And this was the final film credit for him on his filmography.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the much cheaper version in comparison to the previous two.
Well, it begs the question, and I know the answer, but I'm asking on behalf of the audience, I suppose, the listeners, the people who want more British Intelligence in their ears, why haven't we done the other two films first?
Well, we didn't know they existed until we started doing research for this movie, but also it doesn't look like they are available anywhere. There was, I believe, the 1931 was on a DVD at some point, because they kind of point you in the direction of Amazon.
Okay.
So maybe it'll pop up someday on a free streaming service or something, but the 1926 one, I don't know about that one.
It's one of those complications where we have this master list of spy films, but some of them are just inaccessible or somewhat hard to find, and we can't expect you all to, you know, pay $20, £20 to get a DVD sent to your house with a film you're going to watch once just to listen to an episode of Spy Hard. That's a bit much to ask.
Yeah. So, and sometimes movies are just lost, period. Like they just don't exist anymore. That'll be the case of the movie I'm going to talk about in a few moments. But so I'm going to jump over to the director, and I'll get to the other writer in a moment because they kind of tie together. So the director of this movie was Terry O. Morse, who was born in Missouri, primarily an editor. That is kind of his trade, and he had a shorter directorial run. But his first big debut was a 1927 silent film called French Dressing, a title that greatly wowed me. And I was like, what is French Dressing? Because I like to look up these movies and see, you know, just so I can say, oh, it's a crime thriller, it's a horror movie, whatever. French Dressing. I'm going to read you the synopsis from Letterboxd.com. It's a bit of a...
Please do.
It's a little bit of a ... more, but
ooh.
I was fascinated reading it. So this is the synopsis for French Dressing, directed by Alain Dewan. A French cocktail with a delightful hangover.
It's a good tagline. Keep going.
Philip and Cynthia Gray are a pair of recently wed Bostonians, and Cynthia is properly back bay, no action, quiet and dowdy.
Rewind that and take me back through that sentence again.
Cynthia is properly back bay, no action, quiet and dowdy.
What's a back bay?
I have absolutely no idea.
Spell it out. I'm just going to Google it while you read.
Back hyphen bay.
Oh, right. Okay. Right. Keep going. I'll read.
And Philip resigns himself to the quietness, no action, regularity of their home. But then along comes a blonde, Peggy Nash, who adds some action and outside regularity to Philip's life. Cynthia is somewhat upset at this turn of events and decides to go to Paris, the wickedest city in the world, oof, and get a quiet divorce.
Oh.
Cynthia soon finds out that Paris is a really gay city, especially after Henri de Briac shows up and offers to be her guide to the delights of Paris, primarily him. Cynthia quickly sheds some of her dowdy ways and dowdy clothes and is having herself what was once quaintly described as a gay old time. Philip then shows up in Paris, deciding he wants Cynthia back as his wife, and Peggy shows up right behind him, and soon it is up to Henri to make the pairing arrangements for the foursome.
That is quite the French dressing.
Is that not an incredible synopsis? I was like cackling when I was reading it.
I kind of want to watch it now.
Right? Like, I think it's a lost film. That's the one I was referring to. I don't think it exists anymore, but my God, what an emotional whirlwind the synopsis for French Dressing is.
And for those of you that are worried, I can illuminate this Back Bay question.
Yeah.
Back Bay is actually a place on the Charles River in Boston.
Okay. Well, there you go.
It's like it's a neighborhood. So she's a Back Bay something or other.
Okay, well, you learn something every week on Spy Hard. Who knew? So, Terry O. Morse is editing French Dressing. That's his big, you know, debut film. And he does a lot of movies. Most of them aren't well-remembered. A lot of B-movies, things like that, genre films.
Mm-hmm.
But he did have a couple notable things. He edited Robinson Crusoe on Mars, which is a really great sci-fi movie that was the inspiration for Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
He also edited The Girl Who Knew Too Much, which is a spy film with Adam West we've added to our master list over the last while. And he also did a movie that just jumped off the page, Love Slaves of the Amazon.
It's a real French dressing.
So his directing career kicks off in 1939. So he's been an editor for over a decade and kicks it off with The Adventures of Jan Arden, which was about a reporter thwarting jewel thieves, and then does, over the course of 1939, a bunch of movies. He does On Trial, Waterfront, No Place to Go, Smashing the Money Ring, and British Intelligence. That's all in 1 year. This man was cranking out the B-movies.
Given the film's runtime of 60 minutes, I wonder how long it took to shoot.
I don't think very long.
And there's only about like 5 sets. Like, there is not a lot in this film.
Yeah, and I think they were borrowed sets as well. Like, I don't think they built these sets or set them up for this movie in particular.
Wow, okay. This could be done in 2 months, I'd say.
Oh yeah. I think it could be 6 weeks. I think we could pull it back.
I meant with like post-production as well, like editing and stuff.
Oh, sure. Sure. Yeah, I think it was pretty quick. Yeah. So that was kind of his specialty as a director. His right. most notable director credit is actually, he was responsible for editing or re-editing and directing the American segments of the 1956 repackaged Godzilla King of the Monsters, which took the original Japanese film from 1954 and inserted Raymond Burr and kind of built more of an American narrative around it. So King of the Monsters was, for a long time, the version that was best known to North America. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until a little bit later that the original Gojira became packaged and sold to North America. Like, if you buy the Criterion, you get both versions.
Okay. Is it, I mean, care to weigh in on which is better?
Well, the original Japanese one is much better. It has a lot more subtext
right.
that would mean a lot to the people making the movie mm-hmm. versus the American one, which inserts a lot of scenes of Raymond Burr as like a reporter talking to the camera, being like, oh my God, the horror, Godzilla is coming at us, that kind of thing.
I thought you were going to say Raymond Burr just taking it to Godzilla and it's just him punching it.
That would be amazing, giant Raymond Burr.
Take that, communists. Ah!
Yeah, like, King of the Monsters isn't bad. Like, it's very entertaining to watch, but the original is the much better film.
It's entertaining because it's taken from a film that's good.
Exactly, yeah. They just inserted enough American interest to sell to a North American audience.
Sure, that makes sense.
Yeah. And so, the writer who adapted the play was Lee Katz, who was born in Indiana, primarily a second unit director. I thought that was something interesting about this movie. And that the key above, you know, kind of the board talent there, your director is best known for being an editor, and your writer is primarily a second unit director. So it was not the number one calling for these people to be in the positions they are in on British intelligence.
They put the B in B movie.
They do. And Katz broke through with the 1932 John Wayne Western, The Big Stampede, as a second unit director. And that is before John Wayne's a star, so it's a lot of B movies. He doesn't become a star till 1939, and most of these movies are like 45 minutes, you know, an hour long. They're kind of these mm-hmm. poverty row, very cheap productions. Some are okay, some are really bad, but they're kind of interesting. And he didn't really have a writing career. This man is like a second unit director. Like, that is his trade. He becomes a writer from 1938 to 1939.
What a boss. But he's got credit, so like, he is a writer now.
Yeah. And so, like, his first credit is he contributed, he wasn't like a screenplay credit, he was a contributor to the 1938 Kay Francis drama My Bill. And then in 1938 he has a screenplay credit on the Canadian Mountie drama Heart of the North.
Glorious.
Like, this is crazy. I need to track this movie down because it's like an American film crew making a movie about Canada, and it's like set in Edmonton, I think, which is like crazy.
I mean, it's crazy from all the Canadians listening. The rest of us are like, uh-huh.
Yeah, well, exactly. Sure.
Yeah. Mooses, eh? What's the deal with those? Sure is a lot of snow up here.
Heart of the North, I will track you down. But this is...
You are the heart of the North, Cam.
But this is like kind of where British intelligence comes into play, because he does a dialogue polish on The Adventures of Jane Arden, which was the film that Terry O'Morse directed as his kind of big directorial coming out party. Mm-hmm. So he's contributing a little bit there on dialogue. And then he works also with Terry O'Morse on Waterfront and No Place to Go, and then rolls into British intelligence with him. So after this movie, he only has one other writing credit, and it's a crime thriller called The Return of Dr. X. And then he is back to second unit directing. And that is really kind of the majority of his remaining career. He works on The Adventures of Robin Hood, the Errol Flynn film. Mm-hmm. He works on Across the Pacific, which is a World War II Humphrey Bogart spy film we have on our list. And he also works on Casablanca. So this guy actually had some major productions he worked on. Plus, he also went into becoming a production manager and worked on the 1950 thriller The Asphalt Jungle, which is a real classic. And then 1962's The Longest Day is his final credit. And that was a massive 3-hour D-Day epic that's actually really good.
I mean, once you've put together a film where Boris Karloff is bombed to smithereens and blown up as part of a house, where else can you go?
Right? Like, you've written your, whatever, like, five or six movies or whatever it was over the course of 1 year. You're like, I'm good. I just wonder if this man hated writing.
Well, maybe, yeah. I mean, he's like, this is my magnum opus. I can't get any better than this.
Yeah.
I've already taken... I mean, to be fair, is he writing anything on this film?
You'd be readapting the play, I suppose. And the fact that it was called Two Faces East, I guess there was some adaptation required. So I'm going to assume he actually did do something.
Mm.
But clearly this was a man, I think, who didn't really like staring at the blank page and was like, you know what? I love being a second unit director and production manager. Let's do that instead.
Just tell me what to do and I'll do it.
Exactly. Yes. So this was a total fast and cheap propaganda film. It's obviously set in World War One, but it is World War Two through and through in terms of the depictions of the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
So like when it comes to behind the scenes details on this one, like what is there to say? It was probably shot over like 6 weeks as fast as they could get it out there. And they used, as I said, like a lot of borrowed sets. And even like some of the bigger footage in this movie, the aerial dogfight scenes were taken from the 1930 Howard Hawks action film, The Dawn Patrol, which was a big hit in its time.
Sure.
And then they also took other war footage from the original All Quiet on the Western Front. So when you see the kind of expensive shots in this movie, they ain't coming from this movie.
That's a shame because they were an up for me.
Like the Zeppelin moment, that was pretty cool.
The Zeppelin and like the bombers and stuff. And there's some stuff in the trenches at the start of the film as well. Like that looked pretty good. Like they spent some money, but if you're telling me this is all just borrowed from a different film, that's a real knock against British intelligence.
Yeah. The trenches stuff would have come from All Quiet on the Western Front, which is an amazing movie. If you haven't seen it, folks, check it out. It's a movie I absolutely love.
Okay. Did you recognize it when you saw those scenes?
Yeah, I was like, this is not from this movie. Like, they just stood out like a sore thumb. I've never seen The Dawn Patrol. I've heard about it a lot, but I haven't seen it. And there was the moments, though, where the footage just looked too different that I'm like, this is from something else. What is it from? Is it stock footage?
Mm.
But then it's like, okay, I don't think it's just stock footage. I think they're taking it from another movie. And All Quiet on the Western Front makes a lot of sense to be ripping things out of.
But they do some stunts in this film. There is a moment where they're running from bombings,
yeah,
and the actors from this film are in that scene, so that's got to be new stuff.
Yeah, that stuff for sure. But when it comes to like when you're seeing planes flying through the sky and stuff like that, that is not this movie.
Okay. Oh, okay. Well, that's a shame to hear. But then I also understand doing stuff on the cheap. Just look at us.
Exactly. Yes. And so I don't have any box office information as to how this movie performed because,
boo.
I mean, this is a B movie. Like, do you like what understanding do we have of its grosses? It was like people showing up and buying a ticket to like Hitchcock's Rebecca and seeing this movie before Rebecca.
Is that the same year?
Yeah.
Do you reckon they were ever put together?
Well, I don't know if those two were paired up, but like this movie would have played in front of a bunch of other movies. And so like when you look at box office, is the box office for British intelligence or for what the A picture was?
I'll turn the question around on you. You know film releases so well. What is the worst film this could be paired up with that came out this year?
Pinocchio?
I think you got it. I don't think you can get better than that.
Yeah, that would be an interesting one. You go from this to When You Wish Upon a Star. That would be kind of awkward.
It's certainly a whiplash for the audience.
Yeah, and it's also like one is very like just classic storytelling that like the whole family can get immersed in with Pinocchio. And then like the most convoluted spy jinx of British agent right beforehand. That would be kind of tonal whiplash.
Maybe that actually works really well because it makes Pinocchio look better.
Maybe.
Look how simple this thing is. He lies, his nose grows. Duh. Easy.
Yeah.
Geppetto's not a triple agent, you know?
Although this was something I noticed. I did a recent rewatch of Pinocchio. No one really talks about this. Geppetto sleeps with a loaded gun under his pillow. And at one point that happens in the movie and I was like, why does no one talk about this? So maybe Geppetto is a secret agent.
Wow. He's like one of the earliest 00s.
Maybe.
Wow. Okay. Cam is coming up with some Cam fiction here. I like that. Geppetto as a spy. Why would he build Pinocchio?
Well, I think he's like given his life to spycraft, and he's an elderly man, and he's never married. I know there's different versions where he'd had a child who passed away, and then he created the wooden boy as kind of a process of grieving. But in the Disney version, that's not the case. So we have to fill in that backstory. So like Geppetto just gave everything to the service of espionage. And then what is he left with? A quiet cottage and a lonely life and a cat and a fish. And he's like, you know what? I need something. I'm going to build this wooden boy.
So you're telling me that Master Spy, 00 Geppetto, in his retirement, builds a wooden boy that also happens to be the world's worst spy.
Yes, that is accurate.
Okay, I'm buying it. Let's do this. This is I'm pretty sure Pinocchio's in the public domain now. Let's make our own version of Pinocchio. There was two out last year, wasn't there?
Well, there was the Disney one. Like, the Disney iconography of their Pinocchio is, that's still under copyright. But, the story Pinocchio is free reign, the original book, so you could adapt that. I mean, yeah, the Guillermo del Toro one that won the Oscar for Best Animated Film last year, very, very different story, and also incredible.
Okay, folks, coming to a theater near you in 2039, because of 39 steps. Spy Hards do Pinocchio.
As a spy film. I mean, why not?
Pinocchio O?
O?
Seven?
Question mark? I don't know.
Why are we here? Why are we doing this? Why have people funded this film?
Yeah. And the interesting thing about the Disney Pinocchio is it was actually a box office underperformer at the time.
Really?
Yeah, it was actually kind of a dud. And it wasn't until the years that followed with, you know, revival screenings and home video and all that, that it became this beloved movie that everyone treasures. But yeah, in 1940, not a big hit. But what was, on the big hit list, the top three for the year. Number one was Boomtown, which was a Western starring Clark Gable, Spencer Tracy, Claudette Colbert, and Hedy Lamarr. That is a star-studded big Western film that I don't think anyone remembers in comparison to Pinocchio and the next two on the list. Number two was The Great Dictator by Charlie Chaplin, that also features a big speech to the audience about Hitler and the danger he poses to the free world, somewhat relevant to the movie we're going to talk about today. And then number three was Hitchcock's Rebecca, also very well remembered.
Yeah, this film this week definitely likes its big speeches.
It does indeed. And Rebecca, I should note, won the Best Picture Oscar that year. So it was kind of the big favorite in 1940. I will note, though, Gone with the Wind was released at the tail end of 1939, like in December. So like its presence over 1940 would have been profound. So it would have been like the Titanic of 1940, but it's considered a 1939 release.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. I mean, it's weird to not see Pinocchio in that top three.
Right? Like, Disney actually had some real, like, bombs early on. Like, Fantasia did not perform well. There was a number of these movies that we regard as, like, enduring Disney classics that took quite a while to get there.
It's the Spy Hard's way, you know? Not loved in our time, but I'm sure when we're gone, people were like, oh, we had something special going on here.
Cam the Provocateur.
May he rest in peace.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's time that we got down to business and talked about this film. I'm actually more interested to hear from you first on this one, Cam, because you've seen a lot of Boris Karloff films. You're more familiar with the era just from seeing more pictures. What did you think of British Intelligence?
So British Intelligence is a B movie through and through. And we have talked about some movies that also fall under the B movie umbrella, but it felt like there was some aspirations going on. Like, Spy Ship, which we covered on the show and had a lot of fun talking about. That had like a really interesting female antagonist.
Yeah.
That like we talked about for a prolonged period of time on the show and was based on a real life person. And it felt like there was something to hook into because a lot of B movies fall back on plot. And plot is only so interesting sometimes, especially when you're dealing with kind of a cheaper production that's kind of thrown together. Sometimes plot is the least interesting thing about these kinds of movies. That is kind of where I'm going to go with this movie. To me, the problem with British Intelligence is It's very twisty. There's a lot of reveals and twists. I couldn't really keep track of them. At a certain point, I still could not quite pinpoint who is a agent versus a double agent versus a triple agent or God knows what else. So I think it gets rather confusing there. But I found it frustrating in that there was so little to hook into with character. And you have Boris Karloff show up, this pro. This is a guy who, you know, the decade before shows up as Frankenstein and the Mummy and becomes, you know, one of the big icons of Universal Horror. And around this time is doing all these kind of, you know, kind of pulpy B movies. He's doing Tower of London, which is more of like a gothic horror film. And then he has like this. And I don't know that Boris Karloff would have written British Intelligence down as one of his all-time favorite films or performances, but like, there's a level of investment he just brings to a movie where I'm like, that is a character that I'm actually interested in. And so it's kind of like the movie has successes almost in spite of what it's trying to do. It almost feels like an actor who just brings so much natural charisma that he's elevating that which is around him.
Mm-hmm.
But I found the movie just got so bogged down in talkiness and plot and like rushing to kind of set things up in one scene that would have to pay off later. It didn't feel organic. It just felt very kind of like jumbled and thrown together.
There is a lot to unpack with this film, but I think we're basically on the same page. I mean, my top line was equally fascinating and frustrating.
Yeah.
More twists than a garlic knot. But not in a good way, because it feels like it has read that spy movies need to have twists. But as we've learned from, you know, Mission Impossible films over the years and stuff like that, you can't have a multiple like face reveals.
Mm.
At some point, it stops losing its impact. And as you mentioned, there is at least one double agent and at least one triple agent. Now, it took me two viewings to pin down everyone's motives and motivations and how they were doing things. So I think I have that fairly straight in my head. But that's two viewings of a film that really should be a forgettable B-movie. And that's fairly unforgivable. They should be an entertaining, like, whet your appetite for the main feature, for Pinocchio or Rebecca.
Yeah.
And this film isn't not entertaining. Like, some of the action sequences we talked about that were just cut in from other films look really great. I think Boris Karloff is great. He instantly feels like he has gone through the war.
Mm-hmm.
He feels like someone you shouldn't trust. It's like a sketchy guy. He's hiding in corners, cutting bushes, and just being creepy.
I love that they're giving like top secret intel in front of an open window. Yeah. As the guy who's pruning the bushes outside is like, ah-ha-ha,
I've got them this time, the damn Brits. What was that, mate? No, nothing. 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 Oh, no, sorry. I should say it in a really bad French accent. Nothing. Nothing. Nothing.
That sounds like Dracula.
That's actually my point about his accent. I think his French sounds like Transylvanian.
Okay, he was inspired by Bela Lugosi.
Call me Valdar.
I want to steal your secrets.
I have no intelligence. Thank you all for joining us this week. We'll see you next week. That was awful. The podcast is over. We're done.
Valdar would actually be a good vampire name. So
Yeah, V for Valdar. But, you know, it's the film flies by. Like, you'd say it has a good pace. But because you've struggled to figure out what's going on, you struggle to invest in anything, somehow a one-hour film felt slow.
Yeah.
Like, I wasn't connecting to it. I don't really understand how I had that situation presented to me, because every scene is plot. Plot, 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 all the way through. It is completely driven by the plot. There is no character drive whatsoever. So you'd think it would be quite propulsive, especially at a 60-minute mark. But like in the middle, I just stopped caring.
I think also the problem was like you have it kind of framed around this character, Helena, played by Margaret Lindsay, who's, I think, actually a good actress and I think had a bit of a career after this movie. And she's like someone who is, you know, a nurse that is also an agent, which seemed also very familiar from us watching I Was a Spy recently.
Mm-hmm.
But we see that she is actually a German agent. At least it's revealed that way, that she's getting a medal from Germany and they want to send her to London to meet up with another spy called Strendler. And I'm like, okay, I'm following this. They also set up this like love story in one scene between her and an injured pilot named Frank Bennett. And that is like a, I'm in love with you after 8 seconds of screen time. And I'm like, okay, this is my lead character who's going to guide me through the movie. Sounds good. We get to London and the movie drops her for like prolonged periods of time as it introduces this Colonel Yates character who is like kind of like the investigator of the movie. He's kind of the one to crack the case, if you will. And he's played by Leonard Moody. And it then kind of has a protagonist problem in that I'm not exactly sure who's guiding me through the movie. And it's sometimes just having like this multi-protagonist situation, but none of them feel like when you get to the end to kind of tie the movie together. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, who is this movie about and exactly what was it about other than being a World War II propaganda film talking to the audience and saying, we need to be very concerned. Hitler is very dangerous.
I think it is actually just that. I think it is as boring as that sounds. The entire goal of this film is to be propaganda and a bit preachy to you about World War II. Which is a shame, because you mentioned like the female protagonist at the start of the film. And, you know, go back to something we did earlier this year. I think it was this year or late last year, but The Adventures of Tartu.
Yeah.
Again, a World War II film around the same era, same period. And Tartu is your POV character the entire way through. It focuses on him and his journey. Now, he is working for the good guys. But it also turns out that our lady is working for the good guys by the end. She's a double agent. So there should be no reason why we can't follow her all the way through. But it's because the star power is from Boris Karloff that they want to focus on him more. And also these investigators, like the chief of police and these MPs or whatever they were. And it just gets a bit muddled. There is no like cohesive through line for the film that the audience can tie themselves onto and at least allow that to carry them through. It's such a muddled plot at the same time. So you're just kind of left like passively absorbing the film.
Mm.
And I think that is a shame because I think somewhere inside of this is quite an interesting story.
Well, and it's like when you watch a lot of the Universal horror movies, which were B movies when they came out, like they are ultimately kind of like parlor room mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously you're like, well, no, it's a Frankenstein film or a Dracula film or an Invisible Man film. But they often just really are set in like, I don't know, like a sanitarium or a house or something, where it's a lot of characters talking about what is going on. But like those movies succeed because of like atmosphere and they feel propulsive and they have characters that pop. Whereas like this movie also is kind of a parlor room mystery. A lot of this movie is just characters in a house talking about what's going on. You do get, you know, cutaways to like a German milkman spy. There's a lot of spies in London, it seems, going on at this point in time. But like,
it's a hotbed.
It is a hotbed, yeah. Most of the movie is characters just hanging around this house kind of talking about what could happen or what they're going to do or giving double talk. And if you don't give me at least personalities that have spark to them that kind of pull you into the movie, that's tough. Like, they don't have to be multi-dimensional. They don't have to have full character arcs. But there has to be a certain amount of charisma, I think, to carry you through a very convoluted plot like this.
Mm.
And I felt that in Spy Ship, where like our two leads were, the female lead was very strong, the antagonist there. And then like the male reporter was like kind of goofy, but we had a lot of fun kind of tracking his story throughout the movie because it was often absurd.
Yeah.
This movie doesn't have that. You've got Boris Karloff, who's giving it his all. And then I thought that like Margaret Lindsay's good, but is kind of disappearing from the movie. And then you spend a lot of time with, you know, older men just kind of talking.
I mean, I would say, and maybe we can sort of mosey on over to the likes in a second, I think Boris Karloff's character has some sort of energy and star power that he does sort of draw you in a little bit. And you know, he's unique in his presentation. And I do have some sort of positives to say about him. But I just feel like I had this problem with a film we tackled recently. I think it was I Was a Spy, where like at times it felt more like a docudrama than an actual like, you know, drama that we were watching. It felt more like it was just showing what happened instead of telling you about the people and the motivations behind why they were doing stuff. And because you're like, one of the things this film does is you talk about those men in the back rooms, for instance, like they're doing all these sort of double dealings and whatnot. They turn out these are like the British like MPs, people in charge, and they are giving all this information to try and trick Valdar into, not Valdar, but what's the name of the overall spy? What's his Strendler. Because Strendler in this film is allegedly the best spy that the Germans have in World War One. They're trying to catch him. He's in London. They're like putting this bait out. But I can't imagine any government would be handing over that much information to try and get one person caught. I mean, they cause a whole munitions factory to go up, multiple military campaigns to go tits up, and also almost bomb an entire building full of the British Parliament just because they're trying to catch one guy.
That's accurate. It's a little grandiose, that's for sure. Strandler is very important, it seems.
Apparently.
But it's also like, it doesn't cause them to lock down their security at all.
No.
Like, they get their plans, you know, thwarted just by talking next to an open window early in the movie. But like, later on, they're just hanging around this house, just being like, so, that munitions dump, what do we set it over there? And it's like, well, you just got that screwed up. Like, no one ever learns to, like, have, like, classified conversations in top secret rooms. Everyone's like, well, let's just walk around the house and do it.
Well, or do it the other way around. If you're going to like give false information, or no, if you're going to give real intel to try and get someone to show their hand and like to spill that and you can trace it back to the source, give bad intel. Like say the munitions dump is, you know, 40 kilometers down the way and they just blow up a farm. But the people bombing don't know that. They just drop the bombs and leave. They don't know any better. And that they could think it was a massive success of a campaign. And you'd still find the person doing it. I just, from like a military standpoint, I just found that outrageous that they would sort of give that information. But I feel like we're drifting over to dislikes. And I want to get us back on track with the things that we do like about this film, because there are things to talk about. And I think Karloff is where we start.
Yeah.
I think he brings an energy to this film. He has a creep factor I think he just must have as an actor. Like, you don't want to bump into him in a dark alley at nighttime. You know, he will scare the living daylights out of you.
Well, and also, like, he has that bit where they reveal that he is a spy working for London.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking about how the Germans killed his wife and baby.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, he gives this impassioned, just like, my baby. And you're like, I am so sympathetic to this guy right now.
Yeah.
Like, he is so good at manipulating the audience where your sympathies entirely go to Valdor. And then at a certain point, they pull the rug again that he is actually Strandler, which, let's be honest, I think we all knew from moment one, really.
Mm.
It seemed pretty obvious that he was Strandler. But when they reveal that, you suddenly like completely switch in your sympathies. And it's like, oh man, he's good. Like, I think like Boris Karloff, I don't think it's necessarily that the actors around him are inferior. Like, some of them, I think, had good careers. It's just, like, the material that they get versus what he gets to play, getting to play, like, multiple identities, having the accents, the makeup, all that. He just really kind of towers over the rest of them, where your eyes are always on him. So by the end of the movie, I care so much more about him, and he's the villain of the movie that you want to see get comeuppance, where, like, do I really care if, like, a very boring, generic character, like, wins the day? No.
Well, who is the protagonist? Is it the lady?
She is, I guess. Well, okay. I'm gonna, this is like pulling us into dislikes almost, but it isn't, I guess it's more like talking about just like the framework of the movie.
Yeah.
So that's the setup, that this woman is a German agent who's going in. So you are following her as she's revealing, you know, that Valdor is first, like who Valdor is. You're seeing it through her.
She's kicking the hornet's nest. Like, she is trying to get a rise out of this German network in England.
But ultimately, she doesn't really solve any of the case. And, like, you get to the end of the movie, and it's her in the background, standing next to the Frank Bennett, you know, injured pilot guy who she's in love with.
Mm-hmm.
While other characters are in the foreground, talking to basically themselves and the audience, about like, well, they'll be fine. So anyways, let's talk about what really matters. And basically then, the protagonist is almost them, because they are the ones who are conveying all the information. Like, she is treated like a background character in her final scene.
Well, it's that the whole, it's like doing math that doesn't lead anywhere. Like, it's, if you go back through their doubles and triple crosses, she didn't have to be a double agent to get to the same result, and nor did he. they're just throwing these in to be twists for spy films, which is fine. It's what we do. We talk about spy films. I get it. Like, these twists can be entertaining when delivered well. But ultimately, nothing she does in this film would have, well, has any change on the status of Strendler. They were investigating him the whole time. They say that at the end. They were always looking at him.
Yeah.
And, like, they bugged the room to find out what he was doing. And then they found out what he was doing with the bomb. And then they chased him out the building. And then he got blown up. Like, she hasn't played any part in that.
Like, there's a good moment where they send an imposter to play Kurtz.
Yeah.
Like a contact, a German contact.
Mm-hmm.
And she reveals to the authorities that he is, like who he is, to get him taken away, because she realizes that it's not the real Kurtz. So in that moment, your sympathies are kind of with her as a German spy.
Even though she isn't.
That she's obviously, even though she isn't, but you don't know that quite yet. They're still keeping the kind of cover that she's a British agent. So it's like, I think there would have been ways to set this up where you know all along she's undercover.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to watch her navigate very tricky scenarios, and your sympathies are with her as a character, because your sympathies aren't with her when she's a German agent.
Because the film purposely obfuscates the truth. You see her getting the medal in Germany and going back to England as a German spy, and then by the end of the film you find out she is pretending to be a German spy, she's a double agent. So I think you could have removed a few steps and it would have been cleaner. But I want to come back to Boris Karloff for a second, because there's something I thought you mentioned but you didn't.
Yeah.
And in his middle evolution, if we're talking like Pokemon, right? He starts off as a I believe a German agent, and then he becomes a British agent, and then he's a German agent at the end. There is a moment in this film where he goes from pretending to be Valdar, this butler, to going to talk with the MPs.
Yeah.
And it's a small tick that really jumped out at me, and so much so I had to write it down, where, because he's saying he's got a war wound in this film. He's walking with like a limp the whole time. And then once he knows all the people he has to pretend to be Valdar in front of have left the room, just are two like MPs, or I think that's what they are. I can't remember their exact role. I'm sorry. But the two old men that are sort of the leads of this film in a way, he stands up straight and walks properly. It's like watching Christopher Reeves when he takes his glasses off from Clark Kent to become Superman. There is that, like, it's a great scene, I think it's in Superman 1, where he just sort of takes the glasses off and then just stands up straight, and his shoulders go back and he gains like 4 inches in height.
Yeah.
And it's like an instant transformation. It's like, wow, these are different people. And Boris Karloff does that in this film in one scene, and I went back and watched it again on the second viewing, and by God, is it a great bit of acting.
Well, he was just such an amazing physical actor. And that he would always bring so much to, whether it was his Universal Horror work or even just some of the kind of the lesser stuff he did. Like, he was always so committed, and someone who really didn't get his due in so many ways. Like, mm-hmm. He was clearly a incredibly gifted actor that just kind of got pigeonholed for being kind of the B-movie guy.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, this material is, I don't want to speak of the original play because I don't really know how much this differs from the play. But, sure. Like, this movie script is pretty hacky, a mm-hmm. lot of it.
Yeah.
And he is investing so much into it, like into this character, and trying to make it work and feel like a unique individual. Like, my takeaway from this movie, I'll forget all about the plot of British intelligence by the end of the year. When we're doing our wrap up for 2024, it may be the movie that I don't remember anymore. Who knows? Like, I'm not going to say it will be, but who knows? I will remember Boris Karloff's performance, because it's just, it's a movie that's not iconic, but it's like an iconic performance. Like, his character is just so memorable, and even just the way he is like the French butler around the house. Like, he has a distinct personality as the French butler, as the German spy, and also as the British spy, and he's just going above and beyond, like, so, like, such an incredibly, like, lofty performance for a movie that doesn't deserve it.
But that was about to be what I was going to say as well. The film doesn't deserve Boris Karloff, and I think he is lifting the material as much as he can, but ultimately this is just a plotty B movie, so it is what it is. But like, I wanted to just sort of signal out that moment where he stood up. I think it's great. But I like from you, Cam.
Well, some of the footage is taken from other things, but like I thought the Zeppelins over London scene was incredible. Mm-hmm. Like really atmospheric and haunting. And the way they kind of build towards like the action climax off of that. You know, I like a movie that has a satisfying comeuppance for a villain. And watching Boris Karloff get bombed at the end, that looked pretty damn cool.
Yeah, they blew up a room.
Yeah, like the way they kind of set up the cat and mouse at the end of him getting shot going over the fence and the trail of blood. And then ultimately him meeting up with the milkman spy and getting bombed. Like, you know what? If you're going to be kind of like not the best movie in the world, at least end strong. Yeah. And this one had a pretty great end to the Valdar story.
It absolutely did. And, you know, spy films are full of twists, or some are anyway, and some definitely overtry their hand when it comes to twists. But I didn't see that bombing coming. I know they were running around during the Blitz. I know there was stuff going on, but I did not see them just blowing up the entire room and killing everyone in it. It took me by surprise.
And there's something almost like doomsday-ish about those Zeppelins descending on London.
Daunting.
That was just a great visual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, well, we've seen the Blitz depicted quite a few times now on the show in different films.
Yeah.
To varying degrees. I mentioned Tartu earlier. That just seems like everyone's having a jolly old time. You think sure. of something like Ministry of Fear. Like, there is genuine tension in that moment where they all have to huddle down in the subway to get away from the bombs. Like, there, we've seen it handled in different ways. I think this is on the scale of, like, how you handle the Blitz, one of the better films we've seen, because I can't imagine anyone was having the jolly that they were having in Tartu.
No, no. Tartu was definitely, like, playing it a little more of a caper kind of film versus this. It's like the tone of the movie is kind of static.
Yeah.
A lot of it. But when you cut to sequences like that, they do have atmosphere.
That's why I said like a docudrama. Like it was more presented than just like a factual, this is what happened way. One thing I wanted to call out, it's not something I ever really mention, but you kind of started it earlier, is I like that this film has a lot of interesting tradecraft.
Carrier pigeons making their debut on Spy
Carrier
Hunt.
Pigeons. Yeah. Never thought I'd see it. I was like, wow, cool. That's a, it's not a new one. It's an old one, really, but it's cool to see.
Yeah. When that happened, I was like, how is it that we've done like 160 movies or something like that and never come across carrier pigeons?
I'm sure there'll be many, many more.
Well, I hope so. I hope so.
We'll be double taking at it.
I was hoping we'd get like whole sequences with pigeons going further into the movie, but you know what? I'll take one usage at least.
Well, I think they're feature quite heavily in the John Wick films that we're planning on looking at some point.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. But yeah, I happen to see that. But like, there's some other bits in as well. Like, you got the typist that we haven't really mentioned, but she's one of the other German spies in this film, and she basically gives out messages in the like the one of the protagonist's office. She's his typist and types out a German version of Morse code on her keyboard, on her typewriter, to give messages to people in the waiting room. Now, that's just cool. I've never seen that before.
And then that rando character just like catches on to it?
That's convenient, but I think the plot of this film needs it. Although I will add, I did actually laugh at that because she has been writing XXXXXXXXX on the page. Now, I just read that as kisses. So maybe it was a love letter.
Oh, this woman was wrongfully imprisoned and perhaps executed.
She's just like, because all these like little bits of paper that she's writing X's on is going in the trash can. Maybe she had a thing for the janitor.
Oh, okay. Okay. And was it the janitor that was always whistling Goldfinger?
Yes, he was sweeping in the background. You just missed him. He actually just walked off set. And in true Bond style, he's not quite sweeping the floor. He's just sweeping above the floor.
Oh, okay. Classic Bond style, yeah. Mm.
But yeah, I just wanted to tip my hat. It was interesting. Like, there was some types of tradecraft we've not come across before. You mentioned the Kurtz thing was the other thing as well. The mislead of sending in a fake ally to try and trick someone. Thinking about it, I'm not entirely sure why they did all of that, because they already knew she was on their side. So who were they trying to prove it to? It was almost like a show of force for Valdar or Strettler. Chenandler Bing,
yeah,
any one of those. And so I just enjoyed it. That was what I wanted to say.
Yeah. And it's funny because they make you go through these loopholes to kind of follow what is going on. But when it got to the end of the movie, I feel like I should be like snapping my fingers and being like, British intelligence, hell yeah. Whereas I got to the end, I was like, were they that smart? Like, was their planning really that good? I don't know that it was.
I think it was just more for the runtime, because that whole Kurtz, the fake spy thing, is literally only there to maybe solidify to Karloff, to Valdar or Strendler, he's got three names, that she is a German agent.
Yeah.
But they could have just established that he did, that he trusted her initially. Like, because they had a passcode that was new. Like, that should have been enough in the first place. But apparently they needed to do more. Which also ended in this guy's, like, jacket being torn to shreds and him being having to kick it in front of everyone just for just to really sell it home. Like, that guy's just turned up to work today. He's like, all right, boss, what do you want me to do? I'm going to rip your new jacket and then beat you up in front of your friends.
Yeah.
That's a good day at work.
Yeah, I have that note. It just says, come here, you. Rips clothes.
It's how we met, so.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. My Star Trek convention uniform was forever in shreds.
Star Trek convention uniform? What's a convention uniform?
Well, you know what I mean. My cosplay outfit.
No, I was just sort of riffing on like the idea of what's a uniform for Star Trek conventions.
Oh, well.
Is it three-quarter length shorts and an ill-fitting t-shirt?
That's part of it, yeah. Although, like, I mean, a lot of people are wearing original series uniforms or TNG uniforms. Those are the most popular, right?
I know that's what you meant. I was trying to think about, like, but what is the uniform of a convention?
Oh, well, it's got to be t-shirt and shorts. You have to be comfy because you're sitting down for hours in a day.
I was trying to have a bit of fun, and he gives me the sensible answer. He's been watching British intelligence too much today. He's clearly a man-focused.
That's right. That's right.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special report.
Red Alert, Spyhards, we are shaking things up over on the Patreon page.
That's right, we are launching an exclusive new show where we tackle the exploits of the small screen's greatest secret agents, like Jack Bauer, George Smiley, and beyond.
And don't forget, every month you also get two Agents in the Field episodes where we decode the adventures of your favorite spy actors in their biggest non-spy movies. But Cab, tell the people what we have coming up next.
Yes, for this month's episode of On the Small Screen, we are checking in with 2016's The Night Manager, starring Tom Hiddleston and Hugh Laurie. Will this one Le Carre us away? Let's find out.
So don't get left out in the cold. Help support your favorite spy movie podcast and join the circus at patreon.com/spyhards. But before this message self-destructs, let's get back to the spy jinx. Well, we were moving forwards in the likes section, but it's time to go backwards with the dislikes. Cam, it sounds like you got a few. Why don't you lead us off?
Well, I mean, I feel like we've kind of done the convoluted plotting to death. So I'm going to pivot from that and just talk about like the propaganda aspects.
Sure.
And we've seen good propaganda and we've seen lesser propaganda. And when I think of like Tonight We Raid Calais, that was done really well, where it had like an inspirational, character-driven element to it that made you definitely invested in that story. On the flip side, British intelligence, where it features a lot of characters, if not turning to the camera, which they do at the end, but often just saying things aloud, you know, about like the Germans, like it's happening right now, things like that. Or, you know, this maniac with a lust for power. And they're talking about World War One, but they're talking about World War Two. There's a lot of allusions to Hitler. And it's so interesting. It comes out the same year as The Great Dictator, which ends with Chaplin giving that just beautifully written, profound speech about like humanity and the importance in preserving like a free way of life and the dangers of Hitler. Like, it's one of the all-time great monologues in movies.
Yeah.
And then you get this, where you get like rando B-movie actor just turning to the camera and saying things like, "We hate war."
War bad.
War, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing, right?
Say it again.
Yeah, exactly.
No, it's I've got a couple of things to talk about with that, but it's a dislike altogether. It's heavy-handedness. Not that the message isn't right, but there is a way of smartly delivering the sort of the propaganda message that this entire film is here to do, just with a bit more subtlety. This is bludgeoning you over the head with some of the things it's coming out with. I think there's a line at one point that goes like, "I hope what we're doing here will never happen again." It's like,
right.
Well, yeah. I'm sure everyone hoped that when they called it the Great War and not First World War.
Sure. Yeah, we really screwed up calling that one World War One.
Wait, there's a two? No!
Who would have guessed?
We should have seen it coming when we numbered it. Ah!
Sequels are all the rage these days.
Yeah, so it's a shame because it makes me wonder what was in that play.
Yeah, because it wouldn't have been as, I don't, well, you know what? That play comes out in 1918, which is like the year World War One ends.
Yeah.
So I don't know if the play was coming out at the end of the war or while the war was still going on.
Even if there is some of these sort of speeches in there, the messaging makes more sense because it's like, I hope this doesn't happen again.
Yeah.
Yeah. They all thought that. That's, yeah, cool. But when you're saying it in the midst of a Second World War, it's like, okay, yeah, yeah. Oh, we shouldn't be at war. Yeah, we know. And it there's about, I think, three major speeches in this film. Mm-hmm. And they take up like 3 to 4 minutes each. And bear in mind, this is a 60-minute film. So 10% of this, well, is that 10%? That's less. A sixth of this film is taken up with just political messaging. Not that any of the messages are bad. It's just, if you're going to have a 60-minute runtime, like, get on with it.
Yeah. And it's just, it's not elegantly written. It's no. Very heavy-handed. And so it becomes unintentionally funny, which is not really what you want.
Imagine if we did it. Folks at home, imagine if we wrote a war propaganda film and some of the trash that would come out of our mouths or our fingertips if we're writing it is what you hear in this film.
Our Pinocchio movie is going to be one hell of a film.
Man, I've been thinking about that nonstop since I pitched it. There's so much you can do with that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Is someone sleeping with Geppetto and like they ask him a question like, do you always sleep with the gun under your pillow? And he does the old like, just gives it the old Bond.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although, I'm not sure I really want to see Geppetto sleeping with anyone.
I was going to say, you were taking that down a road that I wouldn't be traveling, but you know what? Like, there's a collaboration when it comes to putting together a screenplay and, you know, give and take. So I guess I was going to give you that one.
Oh, okay, so we're doing co-writer credits. Okay, fine. Even though the idea came from me, so.
I'm the one that came up with the story there. I was the germ of the idea with Geppetto sleeping with a gun under his pillow.
You pointed out the similarity. I said there's a movie there.
Well.
Listen to the tape, folks, until Cam edits it to shreds and makes me look bad. It was me.
WGA arbitration is very much in the cards.
I can't wait for our first like big screen pairing to make us fall out.
Although maybe by the time the movie's out, you're like, I don't want credit for this. I want my name taken off the movie. He can have it.
Pinocchio, no. A dislike for me, something we kind of mentioned earlier, is it feels very staged.
Oh, yeah.
It's, as you said, they were probably borrowed sets. A lot of it's borrowed. A lot of it's done on the quick. It's probably done for no money whatsoever. It's just about getting a product out. It's just done very quickly, turning these films over. You said the guy did 5 films this year. I get it. But like, every single room feels like it's a redress of the same room.
Yeah.
Or like the windows have been slightly moved. And so it just feels very, especially because I watched it in like a letterbox format as well. It just felt very boxed in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird because there are moments where the world feels bigger, where you see like the Zeppelins flying over the top and stuff like that. And it gets a tiny bit more like, it opens up, but it comes right back in on itself again. And I just think it kind of holds the film back.
Yeah, I, again, wish I knew more about the original play, but like it makes sense for a play to feel this kind of confined.
Yeah.
And that's always a difficult thing when it comes to adapting plays, which is like, can it kind of break free of its sort of stage-bound nature? And we've seen many movies in recent eras where it doesn't really succeed. Like, it feels like a play on the big screen.
Mm-hmm.
Some succeed, some don't. But, like, this movie, it feels, like, kind of creaky. And we have talked about movies from 1940 in the past and movies around this period, 1939, whatever. The Spy in Black was from 1939. That looks like a movie. And then I watch this, and it's like, yes, admittedly, this is very cheap. This is done very quickly. But it also doesn't hold up. So it's a tough one to recommend to people, whereas I could say, people, watch Tonight We Raid Calais. It's really interesting. Or even Spy Ship, which is a much more inferior movie to Tonight We Raid Calais, but it has fun elements that I think people can hook into. Whereas, like, here I would say, if you're into Boris Karloff, there's some fun there, but beyond that, I don't know.
No, I think I probably agree with you, but I'll save that for the knock list. I had one more dislike I wanted to bring up.
Okay.
I'll mention it again. Boris Karloff's accent.
I don't...
This guy is meant to be a master spy, and he's given us the weirdest French accent I've ever seen.
I wonder, though, if it just sells to North American audiences.
Oh, I buy that in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that people wouldn't just lap it up, but just... I know French people. I did French. Like, I hear it, and my ear goes, oh, no, no, no.
But I also think, okay, so say Meryl Streep is doing a film, right?
Right, sure. The Pinocchio spy film, yeah.
Sure, and she has to do an accent. She's working for it with a dialect coach. She is learning that whole script phonetically, probably in that accent, as to how to do it. How much time did Boris Karloff have to prep for this movie?
If you told me he showed up on day one and was handed a script there and then, I'd buy it.
Yeah, so I'm going to give him a little bit of a free pass on this one, in that I don't know that he really had that much time to perfect a French accent for this movie. It was probably like, oh, hey, Boris, you're playing a French butler. Oh, okay, cool.
Oh, and now the French butler is English. Oh, okay, I'll stand up then.
I mean, that he can do because he was British, but yeah.
And I would also add, it probably wasn't that important to some people back then.
Yeah.
Accuracy in that sort of thing, I mean, even in the 1960s was not the priority.
No, it wasn't. That comes much later.
Yeah. So I'm not going to give it a pass, but it was something that irked me, but it's definitely not the things that are fundamentally wrong with this film, like we've mentioned. It is like the lack of character, it is the speed at which it all flies through, and there's just too many twists. But I think before we get to the knock list, any final notes from you, sir?
I think the only other note I have, and we alluded to it earlier, we've talked in the past about insta-romances in movies. Is this the most egregious one we've come across?
I don't actually mind this one as much, because you don't know how much time they spent in the hospital together. Like, he came in a coma and she's nursed him back to health. This could have been months.
That's true. That's true.
So I would give that one a pass, but it is a good question. I just also, I mean, I don't often add this sort of extra, you know, sauce on top, but Margaret Lindsay is very easy on the eye, so I can understand one falling in love.
That's true. She is. And it's interesting, we did this whole review, and she has this love affair with this guy, Frank Bennett.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't mention that, like, the guy she's sent to go live with to infiltrate is his father. Like, that plot element feels so secondary and almost forgotten by the end of the film.
Well, it's obviously built to come back later, because that's how you introduce him in and sort of a complication to the film.
Yeah.
But you'd think as an agent, she would have gone like, oh, because I think she did know that he lived there. So she was aware of that issue. And you would have thought she had a contingency plan built in place for it, instead of looking all flustered when he was in the doorway, you know, on the phone.
Doesn't that feel like what would have been a recipe for great drama?
Yeah.
Of like, you're sent to go live with this guy's father. You know he's in the hospital, so you're like, okay. But it's like a ticking clock. When is Frank going to come back? What am I going to do when he gets here? Like, that's the sort of thing I think a better script would have built up a little more, because it would have actually invested you even more so in the Helena character.
Yeah, I think if the film had more time, it probably would have had like maybe some letters coming from him.
Sure.
I mean, like, oh, I'm on the mend. I'm looking to come home soon. She's like, oh, I wonder how long that'll be. Oh, no, how long have I got? And then he turns up. Oh, no. And that's a complication, but it builds to it.
Yeah.
The only note I had left is, it's no wonder that the British intelligence services were keeping an eye on Valder or Strandler, whatever his name is. Because he is the worst butler in the known universe.
You're saying you wouldn't have hired Valdor?
I'm not against people who are, like, French. I'm just against people who, if you hire them as a butler, whenever they go downstairs, they immediately leave the house.
Fair enough.
I mean, I have a bell. I need to ring it, and I want service. If he's out, you know, fiddling around with the milkman, you can take that however you want to take it. He's not butlering me.
No, that's true. We see very few instances of butlering in this movie.
Is that a correct word?
It might be buttling. I'm not sure.
Cam's doubling down on buttling, folks.
No, he's not.
Oh, he is. Let us know. Is Cam going to be buttling tonight?
Either way.
It's probably my way, but it, on the off chance that buttling is correct, that would be my favorite word of the year.
Yeah, well, we figured out that, what was it? What was the word? The back, whatever it was, the that word from the synopsis for that movie.
The Friends back bay.
Back bay. We know what back bay means. Now we need to figure out whether it's buttling or butlering.
Butlering. To buttling or butlering, that is the question.
Yeah.
Well, okay, it's Knocklist time, you marvelous bunch of tile sorters. Let's talk about it. British intelligence, is it making the knock list, Cam?
No. This is a very creaky B movie that has some novelty value, but beyond that, no.
Okay, one no. It's down to me now. Is it making the knock list? No, of course not. It's got some interesting elements to it because most films we tackle here have not. There's not many duds that we look at, and I would never consider this for like a disavowed list or anything like that. It is a bit of a mess, but an interesting mess.
Yeah, it's not Spy Ship.
What
and, like,
is?
Spy Ship was shot also very cheap, and it was also 1 hour long. But like it gave me more to hook into. But it was also like Spy Ship was not a masterpiece by any stretch of the imagination.
Mm.
But it had fun elements that we could talk about and have a good laugh at, or it just had a little more of a spark to it. This one lacks spark.
Yeah, it lacks spark. It has too much milk.
Too much of that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's not good for you, folks. Well, there you go. Two no's. British intelligence is not making the knock list. The dossier on the film is complete and filed as classified. So, Cam, the question as always goes to you, sir. What's in our crosshairs for next week?
Well, we are going to reunite with Bruce Willis, John Malkovich, Helen Mirren and the gang to tackle the second entry in the Red franchise, Red 2 from 2013.
The way you say that makes it sound like there's a Red 3.
Well, we'll talk about that on the show.
We certainly will. It's nice to go back to the Red franchise. We did the first one as our Christmas film this year because it featured a brief moment of festive activities. But it'd be nice to close the book for now on the Red story. So your mission, should you choose to accept it, folks, is to join us next week as we head back to 2013 with Bruce Willis and the gang and take a look. Red DOS. And if you like what you heard on the show and you just want to show us some support, please consider joining us over on Patreon, patreon.com/spyhards. Over 50 bonus episodes. It's all going to a good cause to keep the lights on here at Spyhards HQ and keep my school of attack piranhas well fed. And if you don't already, make sure you follow us on social media at Spyhards. That's SPYHARDS on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. But until next week, folks, Cam, strike up some uplifting music. I wish I were able to answer that question. We want to help humanity. We fight wars only because we crave peace so ardently and pray that each war will be the last. But always in the strange scheme of things, some maniac with a lust for power arises. And in one moment, destroys the peace and tranquility we've created through the years. We hate war, we despise it, but when war comes, we must and will fight on and on and on and on.